So what stirrings in American society at a time when this was a pretty radical idea altered the landscape so that even a discussion of what was known as the woman question and positive outcome for the proposal at the Seneca Falls Convention could in fact become feasible? What was changing that laid the groundwork for this?
Well, the original groundwork was there in the ideology of the American Revolution, the notion that individuals are endowed by the Creator with certain rights, and the idea that all men are created equal, that could be read two ways. One is literally men, and the other is humankind. And once you've articulated those kind of principles, some people are going to prick up their ears and listen and begin to talk this way. Their numbers were pretty small in the revolutionary period, but then as women's education grew, by the 1830s or so, in northern United States, you got one of the first societies in world history where you had equal and extensive suffrage, literacy. Women had the ability to read and exchange ideas. And once they had that, you begin to get this sort of idea percolating. The 1830s is also the decade when the Grimke sisters first articulated women's rights. So there's a basic ideology that everyone said they believed in, the American creed. Then there's the spread of literacy. And finally, I think it's clear that the experiences of Northerners in the various antebellum reform movements, and particularly in the abolitionist movement, provided the catalyst, provided the spark in which people began to claim what we would call today universal human rights. They didn't have a phrase for it, but they began to say that neither race nor sex should matter, that race and sex were accidents of the body, as they put it.
So you mean it was kind of in the air that a discussion of rights and equality and adding rights to people who had previously been denied them was now on the table, and that extended to consideration of women's suffrage?
Well, I guess I would say that women had to, it wasn't so much in the air as that they were now in a position to begin to see it and say it. When the Grimke sisters originally spoke up, they were speaking up against slavery. They were South Carolina women who had come north and they were working with William Lloyd Garrison. They were criticized heavily by New England clergy for the unseemliness of women speaking out in public. And at that point, they began to put the pieces together and to say, we can't fight for the slave unless we fight for our own rights as well. So that the Grimke sisters are some of the first to articulate what we would call feminist principles. They, of course, didn't have that term in those days. But that's in the late 1830s, and then by the late 1840s, this had grown to an extent that you could call a convention at Seneca Falls.
You mentioned William Lloyd Garrison, the famous Massachusetts abolitionist who really was one of the great voices of conscience against slavery in the antebellum period. How did that public debate over slavery interweave with the battle over women's suffrage?
Well, there were always a lot of interconnections personally. I think there were lots of abolitionists who were not advocates of women's rights or women's suffrage, but almost everyone who was an advocate of women's rights or women's suffrage came out of the abolitionist movement. When Elizabeth Cady Stanton was on her honeymoon, she and her husband went to London to the great World's Anti-Slavery Convention. And this was being organized by British abolitionists, and they did not want to seat women delegates from the United States. And when they refused to seat the women delegates, William Lloyd Garrison went and sat in the gallery with the women who had been excluded, by way of saying, this is a kind of discrimination that's inappropriate in a movement for this great human rights movement.
So he was a rare 19th century man.
He was.
And tell us a little bit about who Elizabeth Cady Stanton was.
Well, Stanton, along with Susan B. Anthony, they were the two great leaders of the women's rights movement in the 19th century. There are many others whose names will come up, but those two were the great leaders. And in some ways, Stanton was the theoretician of the movement. She was not the person who did much of the legwork. That was Anthony, but she articulated the principles. I think she was really quite a brilliant woman. She did not write her thoughts down. She didn't write a book. If she had, she'd be much better known. But she was remarkable. And she and Anthony were the leadership.
And that was really a lifelong partnership.
Yes, it was. They very different women who developed a kind of rare friendship and working partnership despite their differences that lasted for decades.
Could you just describe in general the resistance to women's suffrage? Who was standing up against this? Who was pushing back? Who was trying to undermine the right of women to vote?
Well, of course, it was men. Men had to, whether they were pro or anti, the votes had to come from men. That's the interesting thing and the obvious thing, but somehow it doesn't really hit you, that women had to convince men to give them the vote. And there were always men who were concerned that, you know, this was going to have a bad impact. There are always people who have a sort of zero-sum notion about rights, that more for somebody else might mean less for them. And those sorts of fears were played upon by some organized anti-suffrage groups, began to be active in the late 19th century.
And who were those folks? So you're saying they were sort of targeting males because males in the end would decide either to extend the franchise to women or not. And so who were the organizers of an attempt to say, no, we should not extend the franchise?
Mostly, if you look at those organizations, you find elite white men and women, quite a number of women opposed to women's suffrage, believe it or not. And they were people who felt at some level or other that they had influence under the current system. And if the electorate was expanded in this radical way, somehow maybe they would lose it. Or sometimes it's just it's a lot more kind of symbolic and cultural. They predict things, you know, the family will be destroyed if women can vote, or children will be neglected, or it's part of a socialist plot, or it's going to cost too much. The sort of fears that you see actually in contemporary America just attached to different things.
And do we have any way of gauging the proportion of American women during this pivotal period who were in favor of women's suffrage and who were opposed to it? Was it 50-50? Was it leaning more in one direction than the other?
Well, of course, they didn't have the kind of public opinion polling that we would turn to answer a question like that. And, you know, each side would claim that, you know, the women are really on our side. I think that ultimately the victories for women's suffrage as the states began to turn in that direction, and then finally the National Amendment had to be ratified in the states. I think that does tell you something about women's opinion, even though in many cases it was the men who were still, you know, deciding whether to let them in or not. A lot of times these things had to do with, you know, men who would say, well, my wife says she doesn't want to vote, or on the contrary, maybe my wife thinks it's a good idea, so it doesn't seem so radical to me. I think the short answer to your question is we don't know. in numbers.
It's hard for those of us a century later to put ourselves in the mindset of people in the period right after World War I, when the 19th Amendment was ratified. There was a burst of modernity, cars and telephones and national broadcast of radio had all suddenly appeared onto the scene, and the war had ended, and it was a absolutely horrific, bloody war, World War I. Do you have a sense of which were the factors that kind of came together so that suddenly it was possible to ratify the 19th Amendment? We could get enough states to support it?
Well, some of the factors are social, women moving into the workforce, and women's support for the war effort and their being able to claim, you know, a reward for doing that. But some of it also has to do with the effectiveness of a movement. The organized suffrage forces began to have some very effective leadership, and they began to have some money to work with. There were a couple of major, you know, million-dollar donors. They had solved some of the problems of what does it take to make an effective movement. And so I think that the sort of political savvy of the late suffrage movement, when they knew how to lobby and they knew how to organize the parades and do agitation, all kinds of publicity stunts, they had a kind of ability to move public opinion that hadn't been there before.
And I guess my last main question, and this may seem like a weird question, almost a century after the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified enfranchising women, but what difference has this made in the conduct of our American democracy?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question, actually. In the 1920s, the kind of sense of disappointment was very palpable. Things didn't seem to change much. And
specifically, what do you refer to?
Well, a lot of people thought that if women had the vote, they would clean up the slums and take care of all sorts of education issues and clean up politics, and, you know, the millennium would arrive. And, of course, it was pretty much women voted very much like the men in their families voted. And so they didn't vote very differently, at least not that was noticeable. So it didn't seem to make much difference. But I think what we see as we look back from a little further, a little longer perspective, is that it was very important that this was a tool that was there for the second wave of the women's movement when it came along later in the 20th century. It was very important as a symbol that women were full citizens. And I think that once you want to accomplish anything, whether it's changing women's access to employment or whatever, to have that tool meant that you had a place to stand and a place to start that just wouldn't have been there if you had really been totally out in the cold without this fundamental ticket of citizenship.
So it really lays the foundation for asserting the privilege of equal rights.
Yeah, the later feminist movement can't happen unless this is there to set the baseline. And I think once we got into about the 1980s, I think it was, and we began to do exit polling, then we began to be able to say, oh, actually, women do vote a little different than men, and we called it the gender gap. And that still happens. We know that women are more supportive of certain sorts of issues than men. And the fact that women are voting means that whatever those issues may be, if women weren't voting, this political complexion of the situation today would be really quite different, because there continues to be a gender gap. It's different on different issues, but it's significant. And it may have been there all along. It may have been there since 1920, but we couldn't measure it until we had these exit polls.
To hear more episodes of Humankind, you can subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast player. A new episode each week. The podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you enjoy this program, be sure to leave us a kind review at iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to support the program, please visit humanmedia.org. And at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org. Thanks.